This is Conversations That Count. I'm Brent Cunningham. This is part two of a conversation that I had with Wes Tucker, who works with Arab World Ministries. Wes's goal is to reach those in the Arab-speaking Muslim world with the gospel of Christ. And we've been talking about how we can understand Islam better, as well as ways that we can really reach out to our Muslim neighbors and share the gospel with them. So I hope you'll join us in this continuation of our conversation and be as challenged as we have been. Wes, we've talked a little bit about what Islam is, how it's impacting us, why it is at the forefront of our mind. I want to also look a little bit at its growth and how it's interacting with us in the West. It's an Eastern religion, but it's making inroads into the Western world. There was a book that came out a few years ago. It wasn't necessarily about Islam, but the title reminds me of this. I think it was The Far East Isn't So Far Off Anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where we're at. I mean, as we look at the most popular religious groups in our world today, Christians make up 2 billion. Now, that's going to include Protestant, Catholic, Greek Orthodox, and, you know, a lot of subgroups there, but about 2 billion of our world's populations could be categorized under Christians. 1 billion, half of that, could be categorized as Muslims. And then, you know, you go down from there. Hindus make up about 800 million. Buddhists make up about 300 million. And then there are about really more than a billion people consider themselves atheists or non-religious groups. But Muslims make up 1 billion of our world's population. This is a huge amount. Talk to me a little bit about Islam's growth and maybe a little bit about this clash of culture as they're growing into the West. What happens?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, Muslims pride themselves on being one of the fastest growing religions in the world today. And they would like you to believe that a lot of that growth comes through conversion, when in fact most of it just comes through numeric growth. Muslims traditionally have large families. Some of the Saudi people I've met here on campus, they have 20 brothers and sisters, you know, or 10. And, you know, that's kind of a standard size for many of the Muslim families, but at least in the Middle East. But there's a lot of just numeric growth. And like you said, they're coming up against, because they're expanding, they're coming up against the West. And there is a real clash of cultures that happens. They mainly come to the West, either to Europe or the U.S., for economic opportunity. But while they're there, they really are confronted with Western secularism. And if you have lived in a Muslim context, Islam is not just your religion. It's your culture. It's how society is run. It's how government is run. And it's a monolithic outlook on life. When they come to the West, they're baffled by the pluralistic ideas that they're faced here. They tend to jumble it all together, thinking that the West is just like the East, and that what they see in Western civilization is tantamount to being Christianity. These are Christian values that they see on TV. These are Christian attitudes that they find in government. And so it's no wonder that they think...
Now, what sort of things are you talking about when you say things they see on TV they assume or they equate with Christianity?
Well, they say that, jokingly, that the number one Christian show in Saudi Arabia, for example, is Baywatch. Huh. Of course, Baywatch is a pretty racy Western television show. But because it comes from the West, they think it's Christian. They think this is how it reflects Christian morality. So any movies or television shows that we export over there or that they see here, to them, they think, well, this is all has the seal of approval from the church, which, of course, it doesn't. And so they think they have the moral high ground coming from the context that they come from. It's a very monolithic kind of outlook.
Now, is that, let me interrupt you for a second. Is some of that what fuels their antagonism toward the West and their anger and their hatred? Is they view it as almost purifying the world by, if they get rid of Christianity, they get rid of the West, and that's all the stuff that's on our televisions? And
that's right. It's a real struggle between, in their minds, what is goodness, what is from God, and what is evil. And in fact, they divide the world into just two camps: the House of Peace, Dar Islam, in the House of War, Dar al-Harb. And if you're in one camp, that's good. If you're in the other camp, you need to be moved into the camp of peace. And that's where the word jihad comes in. Now, jihad, before we go very far in that, that awakens, you know, lots of reactions in people. But jihad just means struggle. And it has many different levels in Muslim thinking. Jihad can mean struggle on the inner level, in your personal struggle to be pure before God, your personal struggle with sin in your life. That's jihad as well. But it goes up the scale all the way to outward struggle, which means conquering the infidel or the unbelieving world for the sake of Islam, either by conversion or by subduing a population. So until that end is achieved, Islam does not rest. It's like, I think it's kind of like this unrelenting steamroller that it wants to move throughout the whole world until the whole world is subject to Islam. Can I just read a quote for you that was found in one of the mosques here in the United States in Houston not too long ago? And this kind of puts in a nutshell the thinking of what Islam should do in the world. It says, Muslims should work to form a society that is committed to the Islamic way of thinking and Islamic way of life, which means to form a government that implements the principles of justice embodied in the Sharia. Now, in parentheses, the Sharia is the Islamic law that must govern Islamic society. Until the nations of the world have functionally Islamic governments, every individual who is careless or lazy in working for Islam is sinful. So the overall goal is to that every nation on earth would be submitted to Islamic law and religion, or subdued, and then their task is over.
As I hear that, what this is basically saying is that for the Muslim to not be pursuing making the entire world Muslim, not just in heart, not just changing a person from the inside out, but governmentally, civilly, in a civic sense, to not be doing that is not an option. It's if you're not doing it, it's actually sinful.
That's right.
So there's going to be a huge emphasis then on this is the goal of Islam. The goal of Islam is to have a Islamic Sharia type law in place around the world. This is not an option. Mm-hmm. It's mandatory. It's mandated.
Mm-hmm. And that's the struggle that's happening within Islam right now, is that the people who understand that, who we would call probably fundamentalist or even radical, understand that this is the goal. Whereas probably the large majority of Muslims living in the West, anywhere in the West, or even in Muslim countries, are very moderate and wouldn't necessarily see that as their goal or task. But as we study the Quran, as we look at particularly the life of Muhammad, who exemplified this type of behavior in his warlike attitude, in his conquering attitude, in his relentless attitude towards people who opposed him, verbally or physically, then we see why Muslims today are trying to steer the whole body of Islam more towards this, what we would call radical or extreme way of acting, which means to subdue even the country that you're living in, that might be moderate, that might be providing you a living, that might be opening its doors to you. We can see this a lot happening in Britain right now. There's kind of a critical mass of Muslims living in Britain right now who are demanding more rights, that more Sharia should be implemented, that they govern themselves even to that point. And so we see flashes of it happening in the West now as the East meets West in our societies.
As we think about Islam interacting with our culture, this clash of civilizations and values and paradigms and worldviews and religions and all that sort of thing, think about our reaction or our response to Islam. Let's kind of start turning a corner, because ultimately we want to get to sharing Christ with them. So talk to me a little bit about maybe what our reaction should be, what the church's reaction oftentimes is. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, first of all, I'd just like to preface that by saying that even if there are extremists that show up on our television screens, I would say that the majority of Muslims that live here in the United States or anywhere in the world are not extremists. But there is definitely an extremist element that would like to lead the body of Muslims that way. This does not mean that all of our Muslim neighbors are that way. In fact, most of them are certainly not.
That's a good point.
I would say that there are three reactions that we can see as people confront Islam. One is just a human reaction. And if you're living in the West and you see Islam making inroads, or you see terrorist activity, it brings up a lot of anger in people's hearts. It brings up a lot of hatred in people's hearts. So there's the human reaction that wants to fight, or that wants to destroy or push back what we see as a threat to our existence, which is, I think, legitimate in a human context. The other reaction that people have is to think, well, maybe we can just ignore it and it will go away. And I believe that I see that in a lot of the liberal media today. They don't want to see the danger that's inherent in radical Islam, and they'll brand what I might say as hate speech, because I would say there's a danger there, that Islam really needs to be thought about and confronted, but in God's way, not in man's way, not in the way that man would. The next level of interaction with Islam that we see is, what are governments doing in Europe as they have these huge Muslim populations living there? Mm-hmm. What will our government do as the Muslim population grows in the U.S., which is, by the way, is probably somewhere between 5 and 6 million at this point.
Within the U.S.?
Just in the U.S., from all over the Muslim world. And what I've seen in Europe after living there so long is that many governments, especially the British, especially the French, have tried to appease their Muslim populations mm-hmm. by providing them all kinds of social advantages and welfare helps in hopes that they would integrate into our societies and be quiet and be grateful, when in fact, because of colonialism, most Muslims that live in Britain or France have a hostile attitude towards their host culture, and they don't want to be subdued anymore. So they look at their interaction with these governments as being more of taking advantage of the enemy's generosity and using it to their advantage. Integration is not working on a grand scale in any countries in Europe. And although governments in Europe would try to limit immigration, they're having a hard go of it because a lot of the Muslims that live there now have become citizens or have married citizens, and you can't boot out a citizen. So there are some paltry efforts being made to limit immigration, but it's just like our southern border in the U.S. It's very hard to control.
Yeah.
Then the third reaction is my favorite reaction, is what should the church think about Islam, and what should the church be doing? And I'm strongly and firmly of the conviction that the only thing that can change Islam in the world today is the peace of Christ entering a Muslim's heart, letting them discover Jesus our Savior and his forgiveness and his assurance of salvation. That's the only real thing that will change it. If we confront Islam with human means, I think they'll only get stronger. I think they'll only grow in their defiance. But when God changes a heart, then that changes a person's motives and his actions. And I believe the church is the only entity in the world today that has the tools to change Islam. And so that's why I'm very adamant at getting Christians involved in face-to-face with Muslims right here in Colorado.
Well, that definitely is a huge difference, isn't it, between the church's response when they're acting in line with what their Lord and Master Jesus taught, mm-hmm. that change happens from the inside out, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you look at Jesus' teachings, and he turns from a cultural emphasis of that day of the external, keeping laws, you know, using such images in his mind as a whitewashed tomb. Mm-hmm. That if you're trying to motivate from the outside, things might look good on the outside, but internally there's death, there's corruption there. And he turned that on its head and really said, start with yourself.
Right?
That change happens, cultural change, world change, kingdom change happens from the heart, the mind, and then working its way out.
Mm-hmm. And that's a great point, because I think there are a lot of parallels between the Jews in Jesus' day, who are very legalistic, with the Muslims of our day, mm-hmm. who are very hoping through their works to please God.
Yeah.
And the only power that can change that is Christ.
For more information on this audio recording or others like it, go to www.brentcunningham.com.
bibletrack.org. All Bible passages read on this recording were from the New International Version, unless otherwise noted.